The field of mental health counseling is growing rapidly, and Richmond Graduate University can equip you with everything you need as a licensed professional counselor while integrating your faith into your clinical practice. Programs are offered in Atlanta, Chattanooga, and online. Apply today at richmont.edu. That's richmont.edu.
I'm Earlonne Woods.
I'm Nigel Poor. We're the hosts and creators of Ear Hustle from PRX's Radiotopia.
Ear Hustle is a show about life inside prison, but it's not your typical prison podcast.
In this next season, we've got stories about the objects people keep inside their prison cells,
about residents in a women's prison who say they want to stay there,
and the most beautiful prison garden. Earlonne, I will never forget it.
Ear Hustle, stories about life on the inside told by those who live it.
Find Ear Hustle wherever you get your podcasts.
It's a mad, 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 mad world under Georgia's Gold Dome right now. Even more than usual, you ask? Why, yes. Yes, it is. It's that time of year. And it's voting time, too, at least in Gwinnett County, even though it's not November. But the stakes are just as big with transit on the line, so to speak. It's a pleasure to have you aboard for another Political Breakfast. I'm Dennis O'Hare. Our regulars, Theron Johnson and Brian Robinson, are both involved in that Gwinnett County campaign, so they are sitting out this time. Kathy Woolard is here. She's a Democrat, former Atlanta City Council president, and most recently a candidate for mayor. Lynn Westmoreland is a Republican, a former Georgia congressman, and before that, the GOP leader in the Georgia State House. Welcome back to both of you.
Thanks for having us.
Great to be here.
Let's start with something that happened just toward the end of this week, and it fed into the battle over the takeover of the Atlanta airport by the state. The indictment of longtime city contractor Jeff Jafari on charges of bribery and money laundering, tax evasion, and witness tampering. He's accused of paying bribes to then-city chief purchasing officer Adam Smith. Kathy Woolard, this fits right into the airport corruption narrative advanced by supporters of the bid for the state to take control of Hartsfield-Jackson International.
Well, it does. And the timing of that, I don't think, is an accident, even though everybody swears that it is.
It's U.S. Attorney B.J. Pack is a former Republican state legislator.
Yeah.
He knows what's going on.
He knows crossover day when he sees it. I think the timing is awkward, but it's certainly not a surprise. We've kind of known that this was coming, and it's just been a long time.
Yeah, there were raids
coming
on his office and so forth.
Right.
So this was an indictment in the works.
Yep.
So in terms of the city and its relationship with the state, does this really hinder the efforts to continue that bridge that was built, if you will, between Kasim Reed and Nathan Deal now that we have a new mayor and a new governor?
You know, it's problematic. I think if the General Assembly were serious about wanting to address the issue of corruption, we'd be seeing a package of bills that specifically address corruption, public corruption, and budgets that would enforce the ability to investigate public corruption.
Because that is the issue that Senator Burt Jones, the sponsor of the takeover legislation, has said, that's the reason we're doing this is because of corruption in contracts and so forth.
That's right. Having an authority, you know, gives you people that are harder to remove, and the transparency isn't there.
Well, and you know, the other thing, Dennis, is that if corruption was driving the takeover, it would have happened a long time ago. Because
there's
you know,
been a history of that.
There's been a long history of that. And so you start thinking about the world's busiest airport, I guess we're the second busiest airport now, being run by members of a city council that really have no expertise in running an airport. You can see where there may be some more room for some corruption. But this is not a new idea that's been kicked around. But I do agree with Kathy. I think that if it does pass, it will cause some maybe some disruptions to that bridge that has been built.
Especially since they're just getting to know each other, Governor Kemp and Mayor Bottoms.
Right. Absolutely.
As you look, though, at the idea that Senator Jones is proposing, a kind of state authority, he said, well, it would run kind of like the World Congress Center Authority, for instance. But isn't there a difference, Congressman, here in terms of history? Because the World Congress Center was a state project from the start. The airport was a city thing. As the legendary House Speaker Tom Murphy said, they built it, they paid for it.
Yeah,
so,
right.
So we're talking about something a little different here, aren't we?
I think so, yeah. It's been the cities since, you know, it's
since
been
the
there.
Beginning.
I mean, yeah, I mean, it's been the cities. And so this is a new idea, not a new idea in the fact that, you know, there's been other legislation introduced, but it would have to be a lot different structure, I think, than the World Congress Center.
I think the state would have to be prepared to pay an awful lot of money to take it over. I mean, the mayor accurately said this is a theft from the citizens of Atlanta, and it is. It's, you know, citizens of Atlanta own the airport for better or worse. And again, you know, I chaired the city's transportation committee when we were building the fifth runway, figured out the bad dealings of the dirt deal. People ended up getting in some trouble over that. So council members that want to pay attention and learn about it can figure out when things look bad, and
sure.
and they've got the authority and the power to actually hold hearings and do things about it if they want to. And then citizens have that direct ability to put them in and take them out, and I think that's important.
And, of course, the state has not been exactly free of corruption issues itself.
No, it hasn't. And like Kathy pointed out, you know, legislators, city council people, county commissioners, it all depends on how much time you want to put in it and how much involvement you really want to have in the situation.
And just on an historical note, under the category of everything old is new again, one of the scandals in the past involving city council and the airport involved the then finance committee chair, Ira Jackson. The federal prosecutor who brought him down was a young whippersnapper named Sally Yates.
Yep.
So there's...
and that goes back to 95, I think.
It goes back a ways. Let's turn to another relationship, this between the U.S. House and the new governor. The House Oversight Committee has sent letters to Governor Kemp and Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger demanding documents related to the state's exact match law. And some other things, too. Now, this is a committee with subpoena power. Congressman, you've been in both places, the state capitol and the U.S. capitol. So what are the governor's options here?
Right now, I mean, the responsibility of Congress is oversight. They have enough things federally to oversee. And elections, you know, are very important. But I just don't see where the evidence is that Brian or anybody has done anything wrong.
You mean Governor Kemp, when he was Secretary of State, right?
Yes.
That's really the issue here.
Yes, that's really the issue. And I honestly don't believe that there was anything suspicious going on. I mean, you know, it all depends on, you know, who's looking at it as is suspicious or not. I mean, we've had elections that we've questioned before.
And you've been on an oversight committee or two yourself in the U.S. House.
I have. And you know, there's just a lot going on right now with all the subpoenas and different things that the Democrats are issuing. And I think Stacey Abrams has really, you know, got the attention of the National Democrats. And so this may have something to do with Ms. Abrams and wanting to kind of maybe keep her in that public eye.
Kathy Willard, though, one of the demands from the committee has been for information not on the governor's race, which Stacey Abrams lost narrowly to Brian Kemp, but the lieutenant governor's race, where we saw a drop-off in the number of votes. You always see a drop-off after the top of the ticket, but there was a drop-off of about 159,000 votes in the lieutenant governor's race, which was won by Jeff Duncan, the Republican, and then a pickup in votes for the Secretary of State. So at least the House Oversight Committee is saying, that's suspicious, but does that necessarily mean anything bad happened there?
Well, they also didn't see the drop-off in the absentee ballots for lieutenant governor. And so there's definitely a statistical anomaly that is at play in that particular race that's not explained easily. And I think that does bear some real attention. I mean, I feel sorry for Sarah Amico, because, you know, when you're a candidate, you put your blood and heart into it. And then when you see something that just doesn't make sense, you know, that's not sour grapes. That's seeking an understanding of how that many voters just sort of skipped one particular race.
Well, I'm going to give you the answer. Short and sweet. Jeff Duncan and
Sarah Riggs Amico?
Yes. We're not household words in the political world in Georgia. And if you look at John Barrow, the Secretary of State,
He was the Democratic candidate in that race.
Very well known, very popular.
Former congressman.
Former congressman, great campaigner. You know, that could explain the difference, because a lot of people, if they don't recognize a name or something, they kind of at least, you know, maybe stay away from casting that vote. And Barrow had a lot more name recognition than either Jeff Duncan or the Democratic.
Sarah Riggs Amico.
Yeah.
Yeah. And also, it could be argued that last year, the Secretary of State's race was suddenly vaulted in its profile because of the disputes around Georgia's election system.
Sure.
People were paying more attention to that race than normally they would for a race that isn't at the top of the ticket.
Yeah, but you didn't see it in the absentees. And I'm not allowed to do math unsupervised, but I think that somebody could.
There's a 15-day waiting period.
A 15, and it's important. But I think that I think until we really get somebody who can do math to let us know if it is that, then I think it does bear a look.
Real quickly, Congressman, this is a committee with subpoena power, and they are at least raising the specter of a subpoena for state officials to appear before Congress or send materials to Congress. How unprecedented is this, and what do you think will happen if they do issue subpoenas, if it gets that far?
You know, I'm trying to think of my 6 years that I was on the committee. I can't really think of a case that we did that. Yeah, I mean,
that involved state officials.
Yeah, that involved. No, we had a lot of state officials come
to
and testify like about water rights and hazardous materials and stuff like that. But I don't ever remember
like a demand letter.
Yeah,
to
like
a
demand
official
or a subpoena asking them to bring evidence with them. They have just come to testify on a subject matter.
So is it possible that one of the options that the governor and the secretary of state would have would be to contest any subpoena, go to court and say, hey, we want this subpoena quashed? Or can they even bring the judicial branch into a fight between a state and the legislative branch?
Well, the one thing I've learned, Dennis, is that you can take anybody to court for anything. And so I'm sure this is going to end up somewhere in the court system, whether it's in a federal court, Supreme Court, or some district.
On a related note, Kathy Willard, I'll turn to you on this one. A leader of the Atlanta student movement in the early 60s who continues to be involved in voter registration, Lonnie King, passed away a few days ago at the age of 82. Wow. Back in 1960, he helped lead marches on the state capitol and downtown businesses, and the protests included a business boycott, which led to the desegregation of stores and restaurants and other businesses in the city. He was one of the reasons that Atlanta was able to come through the civil rights movement without the experiences, or with fewer of the experiences, that cities like Birmingham, for instance, endured. It's interesting that he would pass now and we'd be remembering his legacy at a time when we're continuing to hear back and forth over voter registration, voter rights, voter access.
Except that he is somebody who really trained up a generation, subsequent generations, to really value this ability to vote and to protect it. And I think we are doing him, you know, good honor to make sure that we're vigilant about that. You know, the last few elections, federal, state, you know, haven't been the best ones that this country has provided. You know, until we can dispense with the allegations about Russia and interference of Facebook and other kinds of things, we're taking a hard look at ourselves in this country about how we do elections. And he was somebody who kind of really set the stage for us understanding how important this vote is. And so we'll miss him. We're seeing a generational change of people who shaped the city and made it what it is. And he's somebody who we ought to recognize and honor as he leaves us.
I mean, one thing about it, I think he set an example, too, with whether it was Mayor Hartsfield or Sam Marcel from Buckhead or whatever. I think it was a good lesson for a lot of our city leaders to sit down and talk and try to work through some of these problems before they got to the point of Birmingham or some of these other cities that the city leaders just absolutely refused to sit down and talk about why there was the protest, why there was the boycott, and some of the voter issues. Although, you know, you can't make people vote. Yeah. That is just one thing you cannot make them do.
One of the things that he said in his last interview, which he did with our own colleague Rose Scott, was that perhaps one of the reasons why it was not just a peaceful movement but a forceful one was that he realized, and the other leaders, including Julian Bond, realized early on, we're talking about 1960, was that the way to get people to be interested in doing the right thing is to affect the money. It was a very early realization, he said, and that to me tells you perhaps why not only were things peaceful, but they had the impact to get things done and keep it peaceful, if that makes any sense.
No, I think it does. I mean, you look at, you know, this probably start a whole new argument, but look at Jesse Jackson and Al Sharpton and some of those. They've learned that money does make a difference in how some of these relationships are built.
We're still using that theory with the religious exemption fight, right?
People, sure, yeah. You know, well, I mean, that's
money. If you want to discriminate against people, great, but expect to see your convention business hurt pretty bad.
Speaking of which, that gives us a great chance to turn to the legislature, and we'll start with that. Kathy Woolard, you sat in the committee hearing when the latest version of a religious freedom bill stalled, at least for the moment. Part of the reason was because, although Governor Kemp said he would sign a bill that mirrors the federal language in the Federal Religious Freedom Act, this bill actually had some extra things in it. And is that the reason why it, at least for the moment, has stalled?
I think that's one reason. I think the other reason is that during the campaign, I don't think then-candidate Kemp fully understood what these laws do and the problems with them. Even folks who were part of the original federal RFRA have realized that it's being used for things, not just discrimination against LGBT people, but discrimination by religious people against other religious people. And those were not intended consequences. So to say, you know, if we got a clean federal bill here in Georgia, we're going to sign it because it's good, I think now Governor Kemp is beginning to realize that he had kind of come into the conversation halfway and there's more to learn. So I just think the timing on this is indicative of the fact that it's not going anywhere.
Congressman, you're a former minority leader in the legislature. You know how these things work. Why would Senator Harbin, the sponsor of the bill, add things when Governor Kemp had clearly sent the signal, stick to the federal language and we'll be fine?
You know, I don't know. I really don't, because if you go back to when Governor Deal was governor, you know, he would have signed, I think, the one that mirrored. But they never would take out, strip the other language to give just the regular mirrored RFRA bill. And so now why Senator Harbin, which is a friend of mine, would add something in there knowing that the governor was not going to sign it, it doesn't make a lot of sense.
There is the theory that there are wheels within wheels here. Was the signal sent, hey, we need to put something forward, but we don't need it to go anywhere necessarily, so slip that poison pill language in there?
Well, you know, I don't want
to... That's been known to happen.
Yeah, well, I think that there was pressure, you know, to have the RFRA bill. There's a lot of conservatives, a lot of people that want one. But at the same time, I think there was some maybe objection to, you know, what it could do. It does seem like that was not a real good move to, it would, you know, just to get the RFRA mirrored to go in with something totally different, knowing it was not going to be signed. And that, and look, this bill didn't get any national attention, none, zero. So somebody knew something early on.
Well, it will if it goes. Let me be sure. But, you know, I mean, the solution...
Well, I don't think it's going to go anywhere.
No, I don't either.
I mean...
The solution to all of this is for Georgia to have a comprehensive civil rights bill for everybody.
And there have been comprehensive civil rights bills introduced in this session. They've gone nowhere.
But if you really want to protect people against discrimination, that's the way to do it, not to allow people to pick and choose who gets discriminated against.
Well, you know, we've had civil rights legislation in this country for a long time, and people are still being discriminated against. And I don't know that you're going to ever change that. Laws don't make people do the right thing.
But court cases sometimes do.
It may help the people they put in jail not to do it again, because But sometimes I don't know. You can't legislate people's hearts.
The state Senate defeated a bill that would allow parents to divert, I think it's about $5,500 annually, to private schools that their children attend. And this is the voucher bill. It didn't get past the Senate. Congressman, you were in the state legislature when the drive for vouchers, or scholarships as they're often called, started. And it was a very limited thing when it first got underway. Mm-hmm. Has this movement reached its, say, jump the shark moment?
I don't think so, Dennis. Typically in politics, people put something out there that's pretty stark, and so you'll get a lot of pushback on it. And then you'll wait another year or 2 years, put it out. It's not as stark now because people have seen it, so mm-hmm. the pushback is less. And if you'll remember, go back to Senate Bill 10.
That was Eric Johnson's bill.
Yeah, that Eric Johnson had. And it took a couple years to get that passed. And, you can now put money in and rather than paying your state tax. So I think this voucher thing is just going to run its cycle. It's going to come back until something mm-hmm. does pass. But I really don't think this is the end of it. I think it will come back.
Well, in this state, I have no doubt it'll come back until we're all tired of it. But, I think that bills like this are really devastating to public education. I think that the more money you sort of drain out of a strong public education system in this state, the worse we'll get. I don't see any improvement coming. And we've been having this voucher conversation, this redirection of money, for decades now. And, public schools have not been strengthened. They've not gotten better because people are shopping somewhere else. They've gotten worse, I'd venture to say. And I think until we really recommit to public education, we're going to have this system where if you've got enough money, your kids are going to get educated. And if you don't, they aren't. And well, that's not good for the country.
It's interesting that, and look, I love school teachers. I really do. But anytime the state gives teachers a raise, it affects local government. I mean, mm-hmm. With withholdings and, insurance and everything else. I mean, it really does. And so now we've got local school systems that's paying 90% and over just in salaries. And so I think at some point in time, like Kathy was talking about, an overhaul of the civil rights, we really do have to look at the funding for our education. And I know that QBE was finally funded after...
Yeah, it took decades.
Yeah,
ever
Joe
since
Frank,
1985.
Yeah, since Joe Frank Harris, mm-hmm. introduced it. But we have got to do something with our education. We are losing our society because of our young people not having that education. In Georgia, look, we're one of the fastest growing states, and we have got to keep up with our education to keep these companies coming mm-hmm. here.
And for those of you who weren't around in 1985, Joe Frank Harris was the governor then.
Mm-hmm.
He was a Democrat. One thing that people have raised when it comes to the RFRA bill stalling and the defeat in the Senate of the latest expansion of vouchers is that maybe some of the Republicans who are in purple districts are saying, okay, my voters won't stand for this. I could lose my seat. That's been a theory that's been floated around. Congressman, do you think there's anything to that?
It could be, yeah. I mean, I hate it that you would think that people would do things for political reasons. I mean, Kathy's been in politics. I've been in politics. And, sometimes you get 10,000 phone calls to tell you to vote against something, but you know in your heart you need to vote yes because you've studied it and you know the issues. And so it becomes complicated for some of these guys. And if you look at the purple districts, there was a lot of them went from red to blue. I mean, mm-hmm. you take a lot of those, Gwinnett, Fulton County, I mean, a lot of them.
The Northern Arc,
they
if you
skip,
will.
Yeah, they skip purple. And so I think a lot of those guys may be really, and girls, ladies, may be really concerned about that and have stepped back and look at their constituency.
Well, I just, we're getting ready to have a census. We're getting ready to redraw district lines, and it would be great if we could have a nonpartisan commission that drew lines around communities of interest as opposed to mm-hmm. resembling spaghetti. And really, you know, I can remember because now I'm saying back in the day, you know, when I used to lobby up in Washington, and nobody had a district that was 70% of anything. Everybody had a pretty big base of whatever they weren't that they had to pay attention to. And that's not the case now. People, most districts are drawn with more than 60% of Democrat or Republican representation, which really makes you as an elected official have to pay attention to the more extreme elements of wherever you're from. And if you had a district that was, you know, I always say you can't flip a district if it's more than 5%. Mm-hmm. And if everybody was within, you know, 50, 55%, we would have more honest conversations about public policy, and I think we'd have better outcomes.
But here's the long-term question on this. Are communities as diverse as they used to be, or are people moving to places where folks are more like them? They have more options now. So are we going to see, even if a district has lines that actually make sense, are we still going to see really red or really blue districts?
Well, you might, but then again, you might not, right? You know, the thing is when you look at, you just look at the maps of the districts, they're insane. You know, I mean, Congressman David Scott's district wraps completely around the city of Atlanta. The districts did not used to do that. You know, all of the state house districts, you know, in the city of Atlanta are like stripes. They go north-south, huge distances, you know. Mm-hmm. Certainly within this traffic, how do you even get around your district?
Did you see Roy Barnes' maps?
I'm not hey, this is a nonpartisan statement. Yeah. You know, Roy led the way. I mean, yeah. Gerrymandering's not new to that, but I was mad when he did it. Well, so I just want to be really clear that this is not a partisan thing. This is about democracy.
It is. And let me say this. You know, if you go to the Voting Rights Act, it talks about influenced districts, majority-minority districts. But they have never set a percentage on that. So a majority-minority district could have to be 65% because there's low voter turnout. And so what's an influenced district? You know, John Barrow was at 38%. And so he was a white Democrat that held that position. And, you know, it may have gone down to 37 or 36, and it flipped to a Republican. Now, was that just because of the election year, or was it, you know, that number came down? But the federal government has never set a percentage of what a minority district is. So if you talk to a minority, they will tell you that they need 65 or 70%.
Just to get the turnout.
Just to get the turnout.
But see, I think that's why an independent commission needs to look at this. I mean, these are really, really important questions, and I don't know if anybody will ever, you know, again, can't use math unsupervised, but, you know, but I do think that when we're talking about the fundamentals of our democracy, when the Gingrich Revolution happened and we started seeing districts that were 70% and higher, we lost control of something. And we lost control of representatives to have pressure from opposing viewpoints that they had to adhere to. And that's why we've got this extreme problem that we've got right now.
Well, there has never been redistricting that wasn't political.
Exactly. And even Period. A nonpartisan and commission even, won't even, be political.
That's exactly
but
it, right.
But it'll
it's
be
brass knuckles.
But it'll be
court.
Less. if we had principles about communities of interest and what that looks
well,
like.
Well, that is a redistricting principle. Communities of interest is.
Yeah, but not from Augusta to Atlanta.
I do recall the moral of redistricting, which was given to me by a Republican lawmaker in the state house, I think, as he was looking at the maps that were being proposed at that time. And he said to me, when it comes to redistricting, you have no friends.
Exactly.
And there's more of the Political Breakfast just ahead. Stay right here.
You love free. And at Ameris Bank, so do we. That's why we're proud to offer worry-free, hassle-free Ameris Bank free checking. Manage your money your way with convenient access to digital, mobile, and telephone banking, all with no monthly service fee or minimum balance requirements. At Ameris Bank, we're with you. For more information or to open an account, visit our local bankers in person or online at amerisbank.com/free checking. Other fees such as overdraft fees may apply. Ameris Bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender.
And we are back with the Political Breakfast. Pleasure to have you with us. I'm Dennis O'Hare, joined this time by Kathy Woolard, a Democrat, former Atlanta City Council president, and most recently a candidate for mayor, and Republican Lynn Westmoreland, a former Georgia congressman, and prior to that, the GOP leader in the state house. Let's turn to the vote that's coming up on March 19th, the vote in Gwinnett County on expansion of MARTA, bringing MARTA into Gwinnett County, possibly, say, with a rail station in Norcross, for instance. Early voting's already going on. There's new polling from the Rosetta Stone communications firm. It shows the referendum trailing 51% to 39%, primarily because voters over 40 and, according to Rosetta Stone, Republicans and independents appear to be kind of moving away from it. As you look at this, is this salvageable, number one? And what do you think is happening that has made this such a tough hurdle now to get over when everybody in Gwinnett agrees we got a traffic problem here?
Well, listen, voters in Gwinnett better take this deal while they can get it, because this is the best MARTA deal any county has ever gotten. They are going to be able to control more of their assets than anybody else, and they're getting a fully built system that they're just buying into today. They're not paying back.
Yeah, you're talking about the terms that say Gwinnett, at least in theory, would get all of the tax money that it pays in back into either revamping their own bus system, the existing bus system, or paying for the improvements in Gwinnett.
Yep. They've got an enormous amount of control, and the legacy counties don't get this benefit. In fact, they're still paying to facilitate these other jurisdictions. So I think voters in Gwinnett, A, need it, and they know it, and B, they might not get this deal next time around.
So, Congressman, what's the problem?
You know, if I understand it right, MARTA and Gwinnett County did the agreement last year, August or whenever it was.
Yep, and then Chairman Nash and the commission scheduled the vote for now instead of in November.
Exactly. And so I don't know why they've waited so late to start really pushing it, because, you know, you've just seen both sides kind of get involved in it. And I think a lot of people are really hesitant to believe that they're going to get all the money. You know, somebody's always sticking a straw in some of these pots, you know, sucking some of this money out. But, you know, the traffic in Gwinnett County, I've had several business appointments up there. You have to leave a day ahead of time. And so, you know, will people—
And bring food.
But will people ride it? I mean, that, you know, that is the problem.
But isn't that the chicken or the egg? You can't ride it if it's not there.
Exactly. And so, I mean, you know, I mean, that is a problem. I mean, you go to New York, you've got to ride the subway. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, they're just, you know, you're going to take a cab or some type of transit. You've got to ride it. In Atlanta, we hadn't quite got that mentality yet, and everybody wants their own car.
Kathy Willard, Commission Chair Charlotte Nash, and former Governor Nathan Deal are weighing in. They're backing a yes vote. These are not folks who would normally be associated with saying, oh, transit is the cure-all for everything. How come they haven't been able to sell it as convincingly as the pro side had hoped they would?
Well, first of all, I wouldn't believe the polling. I think we all know polling's kind of broke now. You know, people, lots and lots of people don't use landlines. It's very hard to get a real number.
Yeah, this one had some mobile phones in it,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, so I think the number's probably a little bit closer. But look, this is a business situation. Companies are packing up from the suburbs and moving to downtown Atlanta and trying to get as close to a MARTA station as they possibly can because their workers aren't going to put up with it. You know, if you are trying to recruit people and you've got, you know, a tech company and you've got some specialized skills, and where your employees are going to take them an hour and a half each way to get to work, they're not coming. They're not coming. And so this is a business proposition for the entire region, really.
And, you know, Dennis, you talked about, you know, the chicken and the egg. It's just like with the express lanes up on the north side, you know. Nobody wanted to express, you know, nobody wanted to pay tolls, nobody wanted to do, you know, any of this. And then all of a sudden they open up and now everybody's calling going, man, these things are great. You know, I'm getting to work 30 minutes, you know, quicker. So if that traffic did get some relief, or if people really believed it, I think it would be, I think it'd pass overwhelmingly if they saw that. I don't know what the reason is behind the poll.
Well, here's the deal. If you're from Gwinnett and you're listening to this and you're trying to figure it out, vote for this so somebody else will ride MARTA and get out of your way.
Real quickly as a final thought, let's talk about the region here, because the whole region is watching Gwinnett. This as there's the new Metro Regional Transit Authority, the ATL, just starting to take shape. Congressman, first, with you, your thoughts on what the effect on the region will be if Gwinnett says yes, and what will the effect be if it says no?
Well, if they say no, then, there'll have to be a lot more planning going on about, the traffic congestion. And if they say yes, I think it'll be a wait and see as to how much relief comes before other people start jumping in or are wanting to be part of the system.
But Gwinnett will be a test case either way.
I think so. I really do.
I think if they don't, really, this is the best deal they're ever going to get. I think you will see an enormous amount of pressure from the legacy counties, and certainly I feel this way for the city of Atlanta that's now paying 2 cents on the dollar of a tax, that, why should counties coming into this get that kind of a deal? It's kind of outrageous, and I think it's only going to get more complicated, so they better grab it while they can, because it might not be that easy next time.
And you think there will be a next time? You think eventually Gwinnett's going to have to come in?
Well, I don't know how much business you want to lose till you decide you want to get employees to work.
Or how long you want to sit in traffic. You could get gray hair sitting up there now, I promise you.
And that's it for this week's Political Breakfast. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Dennis O'Hare. Kathy Woolard is a Democrat, former Atlanta City Council president, and most recently a candidate for mayor. Lynn Westmoreland is a Republican, former Georgia congressman, and before that, the GOP leader in the Georgia State House. Many thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
And again, our regulars, Brian Robinson and Theron Johnson, sat out this time because they are working in the campaign for the proposed Gwinnett County transit sales tax. They'll be back, though. And if you like this show, subscribe. And you can do that wherever you get your podcasts. And be sure to rate us, please. That's a great way to make sure that other people can find us. We'll be back in your feed and in your head soon with more nourishing political conversation. Be sure to join us.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
The Gold Dome Scramble podcast is now Plugged In, a WAB politics podcast. New name, same in-depth, on-the-ground reporting from us, WAB politics reporters Sam Greenglass and Raul Bally. We'll cover local, state, and national politics as we go beyond the headlines with journalists, voters, and politicians. New episodes drop Fridays starting April 26th. Listen and subscribe at WAB.org or your favorite podcast platform.